Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This Saturday will mark the 71st anniversary of the atomic bomb being dropped on Hiroshima. The new, at that time, devastating weapon was used for the first time and then for a second time 3 days later in Nagasaki. 166,000 people were killed in Hiroshima in Nagasaki. 60 to 80,000 people were killed. This hour, we're going to be speaking with President Harry Truman's grandson. President Harry Truman gave the order to drop those bombs, and we'll hear what he said in a radio address to the nation in just a moment. Clifton Truman Daniel is with us, and he has said that it is possible both to support the decision that his grandfather made to drop the bomb and to remember the unprecedented devastation and suffering that resulted from that decision. In 2002, Clifford and his family went to Japan, and they met with survivors. They attended a ceremony commemorating the 67th anniversary of the bombings. He is the first relative of President Truman to attend the ceremony, and he has a very interesting background. He's the oldest grandson of former President Harry Truman, and he is the son of the late E. Clifton Daniel Jr., former managing editor of the New York Times, and best-selling mystery writer Margaret Truman. Until recently, Clifford was director of public relations for Truman College, and he is honorary chair of the Board of Trustees of the Harry S. Truman Library Institute in Independence, Missouri. He's the author of Growing Up with My Grandfather, Memories of Harry S. Truman, and Dear Harry, Love Bess. I happen to have that book, Bess Truman's Letters to Harry Truman, 1919 to 1943. Let's start with a historical announcement here. This made by President Harry Truman, an address to the nation, evidently from a ship. We were trying to find out what time of day, but I'm not sure what time of day. From a ship, he told the American public about this new weapon. And here is what he said.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. We have spent more than $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history, and we have won.
And we speak now about that decision, but mostly about his being there for survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Clifton has met with dozens of them. Clifton is the grandson, Clifton Truman Daniel, of President Harry Truman. Clifton, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
What goes through your mind when you hear your grandfather say those words?
Well, just now, listening to it again, just thinking about what kind of Pandora's box we opened.
Right.
That, you know, that lives with us still today. And the words, we have new and more powerful bombs in development.
Right.
Even as he said it, he really had no idea what we would eventually come up with. So I think it's just a little, it's a little unnerving to hear him talk that way. Because, of course, at the time, this was viewed as a great thing. This was, as he said, the harnessing of the basic power of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
We were very, it had been a long war. We were feeling people were scared and tired. A lot of people had been hurt and killed, and this seemed to be the greatest thing in the world. But just listening to those words and realizing, what we've created, a little scary.
And now we have how many? 17,000
yeah.
of those bombs?
Yeah, the number fluctuates, but that's what disarmament experts around that area, 17,000 of them, about 2,000 of them still on what they call hair trigger alert, still aimed at coordinates, still with two guys down in silos, some of them, not all of them, ready to be launched within minutes. And this has come up, of course, recently during the presidential campaign.
Right. Yeah. So tell me the story. You have so many stories, and we'll get to some stories about your grandfather later in the show. But the story that inspired you to go to Hiroshima for the 67th Memorial Service and to meet with survivors of that atomic bombing. Why did you go? Why did your family go?
The simple answer is that it seemed the right and the human and the empathetic thing to do. But how I got there is a longer story, and it goes all the way back to 1994, during a speech my mother gave in Wilmington, North Carolina, on the 50th anniversary of the Normandy landings, the D-Day landings in Normandy. Two older gentlemen tried to approach her at the end of the evening, and she was kind of whisked away in the crowd, and she got into a car, and they missed her. So my wife and I turned to ask, you know, if there's anything we could do. And we noticed that both of these gentlemen had tears in their eyes. And we said, what's wrong? And they said nothing. We just wanted to thank her. If her father had not dropped those bombs, we would not be here. They were Pacific War veterans.
Mm-hmm.
3 days later, I went out. I was a newspaper reporter at the time. I went out to interview a young Japanese exchange student, Shizuka Otani, who was giving a demonstration of Japanese flower arranging, Ikebana. And her host was an older gentleman who was there with her. And near the end of the interview, he said to me, I told her who your grandfather was. And she bowed and smiled and said, that's very nice. And I said, thank you. And then he said to her, tell him about your grandfather. And she wouldn't answer. She looked very uncomfortable. And when she didn't answer, he said to me, her grandfather was killed in Hiroshima. And it was the first time that I had ever met anybody who had been affected by that decision. And I wouldn't have blamed her if she had been hurt or angry, but she surprised me. The only thing I could say to her at the time was, I'm so sorry. Not, I apologize for my grandfather or my country, but I'm sorry you lost your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And she smiled and said, thank you. And when our eyes met, I knew that both of us wanted to go over there and dump her host out of his chair for putting us against each other when we didn't need to be. Well, keeping that in mind, fast forward 5 years, 1999, my son Wesley came home with a book, Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. And for listeners that don't know the story, Sadako Sasaki was 2 years old when the bomb destroyed her home in Hiroshima. She and her family survived pretty much unscathed, but Sadako was diagnosed 9 years later with radiation-induced leukemia. She followed a Japanese tradition that says if you fold 1,000 origami paper cranes, you are granted health and long life. Sadako folded 1,300. Unfortunately, it didn't help. She died of leukemia in 1955 at the age of 12. She was a stoic, uncomplaining little girl, much more worried about her parents' ability to pay for her medicine than she was about her own pain and her own illness. And because of that, she inspired classmates, people in Hiroshima, her family. They all raised money afterwards to build a statue, a monument to her and to all the children killed, sickened, and wounded by the bomb. It stands today in Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park. That was the first human story I had ever seen of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, and I remember telling my son, Wesley, that it was important for him both to understand his country's and his great-grandfather's reasons for using those weapons, but also to understand what it cost the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, I mentioned this every few years on an anniversary of the bombing, the Japanese journalists look for a member of the family for a comment, and I mentioned to one that I had read Sadako's story with my son. And, of course, his story was read in Japan, and I had a phone call from Sadako's older brother, Masahiro, who just invited me. He said, you know, maybe someday we can meet. You know, would you consider coming to Japan? And I said, yes. We met 5 years later at the World Trade Center Memorial in New York, where Masahiro and his son, Yuji, were donating one of Sadako's last original cranes to the memorial as a gesture of healing. And at the end of our meeting, Yuji Sasaki dropped a tiny paper crane into my palm and told me it was the last one that his
oldest died. Oh.
And at that point, they asked if I would come to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I said yes. And that's how this all began.
And you heard from people, not all of whom were very happy, to say the least, with the action that was taken by your grandfather. And you were on the same stage with some of those people, and it was okay for you to be on the stage because you are able, and tell me how you are, to hold both things in your mind and your heart at the same time. The horrible destruction, the horror that these people have lived through, the lives that were lost, but also the decision that was made by your grandfather and all of the vets who have said to you, thank your grandfather for me.
Exactly. And because both are true. Both are, you have to pay attention to both in trying to figure out ways to talk about this, to answer that question. Early on in Japan, when one of the first interviews I had in Japan, the young reporter asked me if I was there to apologize. And it caught me off guard because the Japanese media attention up to that point had been very positive, and it really sort of threw me. I should have been prepared, but I wasn't. And at that point, started trying to figure out how do I answer that. And one of the ways I wound up speaking about it is that I cannot tell a Pacific War veteran, a United States Pacific War veteran, that dropping those bombs was a bad idea, because so many of them they come up and they talk to me and they shake my hand and say that they owe their lives to that decision. At the same time, I'm not going to tell the survivor of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that it was a great idea, that it was a great decision. They suffered too. Both sides suffered. And for me, I think it's just, all it is human empathy. You know, my grandfather always maintained that he made that decision to save American lives. He did what he thought he had to do. He took the course that he thought would end the war the quickest. And I can say that, but at the same time, I can say that I have friends who were very badly hurt by that decision. So I'm in the middle.
Right. Your grandfather, I have read, never spoke to you about the atomic bombings?
No, he didn't. I was very young. He died when I was 15. And most of the time that we saw my grandparents were on school vacation. So to be fair, I wasn't looking for another history lesson. I wasn't asking him. But at that point in my life, all the way up through high school, the bombings were sort of a fait accompli. You know, we did it. It ended the war, and Japan and the U.S. were friends, and it nobody talked about it much, at least not in my house and not much in school.
Hmm. You also met a survivor. Actually, I believe you met, you'll have to tell me where you met, but I'm reminded of your getting a phone call on one of your birthdays from another survivor of Hiroshima. It's quite a story, isn't it?
Shigeko Sasamori. Yeah, Shigeko survived Hiroshima. She, because we had begun a campaign of firebombing Japan in March 1945. A lot of the major cities had begun building firebreaks to minimize the damage. They were sure they were going to be next, Hiroshima included. So Shigeko and a lot of other children, 12 and 13 years old, were outside knocking down houses, pulling down wooden homes to make larger lanes of escape for people and to keep the fire from leaping from one neighborhood to another. And the bomb, I can't remember exactly how close she was, but close enough that she was very, very badly burned. Mm. And she was one of the Hiroshima maidens who came to this country in 1955 for plastic surgery under the guidance of Norman Cousins and Reverend Tanimoto in Japan and many members of the Quaker Church.
Mm.
And they came for plastic surgery. Shigeko stayed. I mean, she went home for a while, but she came back. She lives in Los Angeles today. And Shigeko and I met in New York the spring before my family and I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2012. And Shigeko is a sweetheart. The only reason she tells her story, and the only reason many of the survivors tell their story, is they don't want it to happen again. They don't want it to happen to anybody else. And she's just a sweet person. We got along very well immediately. And I came back home to Chicago, and I was driving home, having dropped my son off at high school, and I checked a cell phone message. It was the day after my birthday, and I checked my cell phone messages, and someone with a very lovely soprano voice was singing me happy birthday. Well, it turned out to be Shigeko. And, of course, I had then, her birthday's, I think, about two weeks after mine, so I had to quick try and learn happy birthday in Japanese and leave her a message. So, and now it's back and forth. Now every year on the birthdays, there's exchanged phone messages.
And I wasn't aware that what organization has brought atomic bomb survivors to share their experience with many New York students.
More than 30,000 high school students in New York over 8 years. That was Hibakusha stories. Hibakusha is the Japanese word for a survivor. It translates roughly to bomb-affected person or bomb-affected people. And this organization, founded by Dr. Kathleen Sullivan and Robert Krinquist in New York, brought survivors twice a year, roughly, to speak to high school students and just, you know, made the rounds of high school students in New York and its boroughs, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens. And I joined them in the fall of 2012 for the first time. So we would appear on stage together.
And when you heard some of the survivors, which is understandable, saying that they could never forgive the United States for what they did to their country or to their family, how do you take that in?
I have actually never had a survivor tell me face-to-face that they could never forgive the United States or my grandfather. One of the first survivors I met, in fact, the first person to ever tell me her story, when I met Masahiro and Yuji Sasaki, they talked about Sadako. They talked about her illness, about her stoicism. They didn't talk about August 6th. So the first person I ever heard an in-person atomic bombing story from was Setsuko Thurlow. And Setsuko is a Canadian citizen. And she has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's been speaking out against nuclear proliferation almost since the day that she crawled. A soldier helped pull her from the rubble of an Army administration building where she had been. She and 29 other girls had been learning to operate Japanese secret code machines. And the first thing Setsuko said to me was, your grandfather did not need to use that terrible weapon. It was cruel and unnecessary. From her point of view, Japan had nothing. It was defeated. It was blockaded. They had schoolgirls using their secret code machines. There was no one left. It was the elderly and women and children doing the work. So from her point of view, it was not necessary. I think she believes it would have been a better waiting game. Just wait it out, blockade and wait it out. So that was the first person. But Setsuko and I got past that. We were both kind of wary of each other because I knew going in that she was not a Truman fan, so to speak. But she was afraid that what I was going to do was start spouting, you know, start defending the decision and start saying things like, well, you know, you asked for it or some such nonsense.
Right.
And that wasn't the case. I was there to listen. And once we got past that, we've been friends ever since. And I've told Setsuko before, and she knows this, that any time we are together on stage talking to people, she should express her opinion. If we're not open about it and honest about it and listen to each other, we don't get anywhere.
It really sounds, Clifton, like you have been able to walk in another person's shoes.
I don't think I'll ever be able to do that with the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've tried, but I don't think any of us can ever really understand what that must have been like.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're speaking this hour. Today is 2 days before the 71st anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, followed 3 days later by Nagasaki. And our guest has a very interesting connection, historical, familial connection to President Harry Truman. He is his grandson. And, of course, President Truman was president when the bomb was dropped. But he also has gone to Japan, has met with survivors, and has had some very moving encounters with many of the survivors. He brought his family to one of the memorial services in 2012. He's also done some writing. We'll talk about his grandfather a little bit later on. He says his grandfather was horrified by the destruction, and it has weighed, obviously, on Clifton's mind as well. Clifton Truman Daniel is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always like to get your messages. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. And Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. I'm really enjoying this program, as always.
Thanks, Scott.
To put your grandfather's actions in perspective, I remember reading once that General Curtis LeMay, who was in charge of the Army Air Corps bombing campaign of Japan, once told his aide, if we should lose this war, we would certainly be convicted of war crimes. And he was not talking about Nagasaki or Hiroshima. He was actually referring to the firebombing you referenced earlier and the destruction that was done to all the civilians in Tokyo and the other cities that that they sent the B-29s over.
Yeah, exactly. The firebombing raid over Tokyo, I think around March 9th, 1945, destroyed 16 square miles of the city. They said that it got so hot the water in the rivers boiled.
Mm.
But, you know, in talking, I try not to, and you're absolutely right, but I try not to bring that up too often, because some people see it as, you don't want people thinking that you're trying to minimize the atomic bombings.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm careful about that, but you're right, it was all horror. A radio host here in the States, Dan Carlin, once called, he said the atomic bombs certainly were an atrocity, but they were the last atrocity in a war full of atrocities, and he meant on both sides.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, just in passing, I'd like to say that as somebody who is a history major as an undergraduate, I have come to be a great fan of your grandfather, and I think... you know, that what he was able to accomplish in a very trying and difficult time in terms of the Marshall Plan and everything like that. Now, I'd like leadership like that to be available these days. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, thank you, Scott. I've got a bumper sticker on my car that says Harry Truman for president in 2016.
Do you really?
I do. I don't think it's going to work, but...
No, it probably isn't. Have you pored over the history of your grandfather's presidency?
Yeah, for years. And I'm by no means a great scholar, but he was my grandfather, so
right.
I have been reading about him on and off for years in various ways. So, yeah.
I was interested in part of the book that you wrote about him. It said that you say that you didn't even know your grandfather had been president until you were 6 years old.
Yeah, I went to school one morning, and a teacher walked up to me and said, "Wasn't your grandfather president of the United States?" And I said, "I don't know.
I don't know.
I hadn't heard that." And my mother used to love telling the story about that for years afterwards, even when I was well into adulthood. I went home that afternoon, and I dropped my book bag at the door, and I marched up to her, and I put my hands on my hips and said, "Mom, did you know?
Did you know, Mom?
Did you know that Grandpa Truman has been president?" And she said, "Yes."
Yeah.
And she said, "Just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head."
Oh, it's really...
So they were trying to keep it out of our lives and keep our lives as normal as possible.
Hmm. Thanks, Scott, so much for your call. Let's go next to Greg in Racine. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. This is quite interesting. Thank you so much. Mr. Daniels, I want to say first, one of my prized possessions is in my extensive record collection. I have the RCA Victor LP of your mother singing various American folk songs.
Oh,
wow.
which is really, I can't think of a single record that I... prize as highly. It's quite a collector's item, and it's neat to have.
She would have liked you a lot better than me, Greg. The first time she put on a record of her singing for my younger brother William and myself, both of us, we weren't expecting it to be operatic, so both of us burst out laughing.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah, she was not happy. She never played it for us again.
I've always thought that, I hadn't thought of this in a while, but until your conversation, I think one of the largely untold stories in this is of exactly what the Japanese government's response was, first to Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. We know ultimately, of course, that they surrendered. But I've always been curious about exactly what the nature of their conversations and debates were. I mean, were they so stunned that no meaningful conversations or debates occurred, or is it, do we know, have any means of knowing, and I don't know if you explore this at all in your book, just was this always a foregone conclusion that they would surrender? Was there no other thing for them to do? Or just what occurred at the highest levels of the Japanese government in response to this? I'm just curious if you touch on that at all in what sounds like a really interesting book.
Thank you. And this is not the book I'm working on now is more of a memoir, more of meeting the survivors. As I understand it, from working with this the last 4 years and talking to people and reading, the Japanese military, which were very much, most of them, many of them, still bent on fighting the war to the bitter end. That survivors will tell you that they were being told they were all going to fall like cherry blossoms. It was going to be a glorious end. They were not going to let their country be taken. The government would rather they all die. This was not universal, but this was the heads of the army and the navy were going to fight it all out. And it took, and I'm not as good on this as I should be. It took intervention at the end from the emperor. And one of we had in 2014, at the Truman Little White House in Key West, where my grandfather spent his working vacations. They have an annual historic symposium, the Truman Legacy Symposium. We look at decisions of the Truman era and how they still reverberate today. And we did the bombings in 2014, and our keynote speakers were Setsuko Thurlow, who I mentioned earlier, and Yasuaki Yamashita, who survived Nagasaki. And then they did the keynote the first night, and the second day we spent all day with scholars talking about the decision, talking, what other paths were there. And one of the talks that came up was on Ketsugo, which was the Japanese strategy of fighting us to a bloody end, making us pay so dearly for each inch of real estate that we would eventually lose heart and sue for peace. So there was that attitude. Another interesting thing that came out of that was the idea that it took both the atomic bombings and the entry of Russia into the war to stop the war. The atomic bombings on the home front to rattle the Japanese living in Japan, and the Russian entry into the war to rattle the generals fighting in Manchuria. There were 4 million, I think about 4 million Japanese soldiers fighting in Manchuria. And one, they didn't often communicate very clearly with each other, communications being what they were. So it took that, may very well have taken that double to end the war.
Mm. Thank you so much, Greg, for your interesting call. We're speaking this hour a couple days before the August 6th anniversary of the atomic bomb falling on Hiroshima. We're speaking with the grandson of President Harry Truman this hour of the show, Clifton Truman Daniel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I just wanted to add that there's a fairly recent book about the end of World War II. They said your grandfather was left out of everything that was going on, and President Roosevelt told him nothing. And I remember I heard it being said that he was not even told about the atomic bombs, and he found out about the first bomb from reading the newspapers, and that there was no authorization for dropping it, but there is for the second.
You were right that President Roosevelt did not tell him about the atomic bombs. He was not briefed until right after he took the oath of office. Secretary of War Henry Stimson took him aside and said, very briefly, he said, we have a very powerful new weapon, a top-secret weapon. You need to know about this. I will brief you more fully. And he did in the coming days. So my grandfather knew even before they tested the bomb. They tested the bomb on July 16th. He knew before they tested what was going on. He may also, the light bulb may have gone off for him. He may have had some inkling, because as a senator just a few years before, he was investigating waste and fraud in military production. And he got word that millions and millions of dollars were disappearing into the middle of nowhere in Tennessee, what was essentially what everybody thought was a collection of family-owned farms.
Oh.
Of course, it turned out to be, it is now called Oak Ridge. It was where they refined the uranium. But he sent a couple, he began to send a couple of inspectors out there, and Henry Stimson took him aside and said, please don't, this is top secret, it's legitimate, I can't tell you what it is. And Grandpa immediately, out of patriotism and respect for Stimson, immediately called his inspectors back. But then when Stimson told him about the bomb, the light bulb must have gone off. Oh, that's what you were doing. So he knew about it, and actually the surprise for Grandpa came when the second bomb was dropped so quickly after the first, and he immediately took back control of those nuclear weapons from the military. And that control of nuclear weapons still resides with the President of the United States today, because he didn't want it used indiscriminately. And there was one, we only have one piece of paper that authorizes the use of the first bomb. And it essentially says, and I think I'm quoting it completely, it essentially says, release when ready. And it's just written on a piece of paper, and it's on display at the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri.
Mm. You wonder about all of those people who knew about it, who had built it, your grandfather, people who had some idea that this maybe was going to happen, but had no idea what really was going to happen. You wonder if it gave them nightmares, Clifton, or if they were fretted about this, because it's a huge thing to take this new weapon and unleash it and not know exactly what the devastation is going to be.
Right, and a lot of the scientists and people in the military, the decision makers, a lot of people backpedaled afterward,
mm-hmm.
having supported the use of it to begin with, and then backpedaled when they saw what it had done, which people debate whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a very human thing. People were horrified at what this weapon could do.
Right.
And if you talk to people in Oak Ridge, and Oak Ridge preserves their history very, very well, you talk to them, they'll tell you that on the day, you know, not a lot of people knew exactly what they were producing. They were told it was tube alloy. So nobody except the very top scientists and administrators knew what they were doing, and they kept it secret. The kids, they had children. Scientists had children. They all lived in the town that they built from out of, you know, from nothing. The kids on the football team never played home games.
Huh.
They went out to play games. No one was ever allowed inside the fence, and the kids never wore their names on their jerseys.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
So they did a lot of
interesting.
Little...
Right.
Yeah, they did. So, but it was that they kept a $2 billion operation going on in three major sites and dozens of smaller ones. That they kept it a secret is quite something. And, of course, we know now they didn't keep it a secret. The Russians knew about it.
Yeah. What did your children think when you took them to Hiroshima?
I took my two sons. My oldest child, Amy, could not go. She had work. Wesley has been he's the one that brought the book home. He's brought Sadako's
right.
story home. So
yes.
He's been in this from the beginning. So he was, and when he brought his teacher, Rosemary Barilla, here in Chicago, Rosemary didn't just give them the book. She took them to a Japanese restaurant. She taught them Japanese history and culture. They had tea ceremonies in the classroom. So it brought all of Japan into our lives. So Wesley and I and his mother and his younger brother, Gates, were all just enjoying being in Japan on top of this very serious mission. I know Wesley, it means a lot to Wesley. He went back with me the following year to collect survivor testimony on, you know, to film survivor testimony for the Truman Library. So he and I have been back again. But he works very closely with me on this. And Gates right now, I'm looking at his copy of David McCullough's book, Truman. Gates is now working his way through that book. So he's picked it up as well.
Great. What was the story? Oh, that was another funny story of your grandfather when you and your brother were 4 and 2, I think. Your grandfather is reading you Thucydides? Oh, my gosh.
I had to be really careful with him. He was in the apartment early one morning having gotten up and gone for a walk. And he stayed down. He and my grandmother were staying down the street at a hotel, and they got up. And he got up and got his morning walk out of the way and breakfast. And then he came over to our apartment and threw the newspapers on the floor from the hotel and read until somebody woke up. And my brother and I tried to sneak past him to get to the television set in the den, and he caught us and took a copy of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War
of
off
course.
The top shelf and sat us down and read to us. And you're right, I was 4, my brother was 2. So you, You had to watch Grandpa. He would give you a history lesson.
Yeah, I guess. Let's go to Tony next in Ironwood. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi, Tony.
You know, I'm fascinated by this discussion because for years I used to live on Martha's Vineyard. We used to go out to the lighthouse on Hiroshima Day and all of have an observance there. We'd meet in silence and share different things. I'm also a Quaker. I'm very much against war, but I had to share at one of these observances the truth, which was my father was a bomber pilot, and he was scheduled to bomb Japan. And he would have been fighting there had the bomb not been dropped. So we can speculate all we want about how long the war might have lasted, but it seems to me it ended the war, and that has to be the bottom line.
Yeah, and I'm always careful about talking about this because my goal is bringing people together. But I think that you're right. We can never know for sure what would have happened, although history seems to be leading us in the direction that the fighting would have continued. But again, you know, the there was a man in Hiroshima named Hiromu Morishita who I had just finished answering the apology question in Tokyo, and I was a little rattled, and he was one of the first survivors I met on the first day in Hiroshima. And he sat down and he said, you know, I actually met your grandfather. I went on a peace mission to America in 1964, and we went to the Truman Library and I met him. And the head of our delegation asked for an apology, and Mr. Truman said no. And I thought, okay, now how do I answer this? And he said very quickly, but that's not what I want from you. I just want to tell you my story. And he wound up telling me that there was a time when he thought an apology was warranted, but he let go of that because he said that so many Americans had come to Hiroshima to help the survivors and help rebuild, many of them Quakers. Hmm. And he had been, I'm sure you know this, there is a monument to Barbara Reynolds in Hiroshima Peace Park. I think she's one of only two Americans who have monuments to them in the Peace Park, the other being Norman Cousins. But Mr. Morishita has spent a lot of his youth after the bombing working with Quaker missionaries and people who were helping put the city back together.
Thank you so much, Tony, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Harry Truman's grandson is with us this hour, Clifton Truman Daniel. There have been a number of news reports about him and his grandfather. Of course, we're talking to him a couple days before the release of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and 3 days later in Nagasaki. Clifton has gone to a memorial service. He's been actually to Japan a couple times and brings the stories of survivors and the whole history of this time in the world's history, which was pretty darn difficult, wasn't it? So we're looking at a lot of issues with him, reconciliation, apologies, his being the first family member to go to Hiroshima and to meet with so many people and listen to their stories. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Carol, our next caller from Oak Creek. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, why would President Roosevelt keep this Manhattan Project secret from President Truman so late in the game? It's my understanding that Roosevelt wasn't quite fond of Truman, and he kept many secrets from him, and Truman was bombarded after his death with a whole bunch of things, and I'm wondering, why do you think he kept the secret, especially the Manhattan Project?
President Roosevelt kept secrets from everybody. I don't think that he had any special enmity for my grandfather. And in fact, my grandfather was a loyal New Deal Democrat who stayed with FDR's programs. So this was President Roosevelt's way of governing. He liked to hold most of the cards himself, and he only let people know what he absolutely felt they had to know. And plus, I think that there was, as bad as President Roosevelt's health was at that point, he fully expected to finish out the term and finish out the war. You know, he strong character, strong will, and he fully expected to bring it to a conclusion. So I don't think he even considered that he needed to tell my grandfather. Just as an aside, I wound up making a bit of a joke of that with David Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's grandson, when we were together last year. I mentioned to him one night, I said, you know, your grandfather didn't tell my grandfather anything. And David let that slide. And the next morning when we came down for breakfast, we were getting ready to go do a program together. I said, how are you, David? And he said, I'm not going to tell you. So it was, and David would tell you, this was President Roosevelt's style of governing, very much in contrast to my grandfather's, which was to be very open and share tasks and share duties. So Grandpa, when he got into office, it spread it all out. It became much more broad-based.
Hmm. Did you have a chance to talk with President Obama at all after his visit?
No. No, I was in California at the time with Masahiro Sasaki, Sadako's older brother, and Yuji Sasaki. We were there in support of a film about Sadako, Orizuru, 2016. Orizuru is the Japanese name for crane. And we were out there. This is a 25-minute film that the filmmakers designed for classrooms. So we were going around to schools and giving talks. And, of course, this is the same time that the president was in Hiroshima. So the Japanese media got us out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning to ask us what we thought. And people had asked before, you know, are you going on the trip? Were you invited? Did you talk to the president? No, this was, you know, this is something the president did all on his own, which I thought, and I thought he did it well. I thought he did it as well as any American president could.
I do think he could have done it better if he had invited you. No, seriously.
Well, thank you.
All right.
I don't know what to say to that, except I didn't get to go, and I was happy in California.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I'm wondering, whatever happened to the last paper crane?
The Sasaki family still has it.
I thought they gave it to you.
No, they let me hold it.
Oh, they let you hold it.
He just put it into my palm for a minute.
Oh.
There's a picture somewhere of me holding it. No, they did not give it to me. I have paper cranes. I have a... my wife made a shadow box for some paper cranes that Masahiro and Yuji folded for me. I have that on the wall along with pictures of Sadako. But no, the family, those original paper cranes are very precious. There are some of them, and I believe President Obama saw them. There are some of them in the Peace Museum in Hiroshima, and the family has several. They just recently, they've donated one to the Truman Library in Independence. We did that in November last year, and in May they donated two, one to the Simon Wiesenthal Center and Museum of Tolerance, a Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, and one at the Japanese National Museum, also in Los Angeles.
Let's go next to Kevin in Baraboo. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Thanks again for an awesome show. Say, I did have, well, I guess my story is very much like a few callers ago, Tony's. My dad was a tail gunner, and he was supposed to be part of that invasion. Basically, the situation that I really appreciate Clifton Trunia Daniels for what he's really done. You know, it's awesome to be able to say things like, you know, you got to see both sides of this issue, and you can't condemn either one of them. I am an artist that, you know, does create some artwork, and you know, Kathleen has seen some of mine. I was wondering if there's any short little statement that you could see as far as put into a piece of artwork?
There was a good statement, a statement that Sadako Sasaki herself said of those cranes at one point. She said, I will write peace on your wings and you will fly all over the world. And the Truman Library director, Dr. Kurt Graham, had a very nice ending to the program in November when the Sasakis donated one of Sadako's cranes to the library. He said, you know, she did not get her wish to live. She did not get her wish to be healthy and to live, but because of, you know, if we keep doing these kinds of programs, if we keep talking to each other, she may yet get her wish for world peace. It's a nice ending.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I read the book also, and I'm a retired art teacher, so I've actually, you know, shared the folding of cranes to a lot of students over the years. And again, thank you very much for what you're doing, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks
Bye.
For the call. Mike in Mount Horeb. Hi.
Hi. Again, as the other callers have said, fabulous program. You always do great things on the radio for us. This is my comments about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the nuclear cat was kind of out of the bag, if you understand what I mean. Other countries were thinking about and planning on use or development of nuclear weapons. So do you think, and this is a longer view, maybe historic look at this, do you think that the thousands of people who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the example that stayed hands during the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, things like that?
That's been said, that, you know, they've been called the sacrificial lambs, that because we saw what those bombs could do, that we've been lucky. We haven't done it again. Again, that's something that you want to talk about very carefully, because, you want to not sound like you were making excuses or in any way tipping the conversation to where it was okay. But that has come up. And I think that the survivors themselves have gone us one better on that. Those survivors who talk about this, who share their stories. And it's painful for them every time they do it, to relive losing little sisters and little brothers, watching their families die in fires started by the bomb. Watching their families die of radiation poisoning, being sick themselves. They relive this over and over and over again for only one reason, and that's so that we understand how horrible it is and that we don't do it again. But, yeah, that's, you know, you're right. That has certainly come up. We did let a cat out of the bag, but I don't think anybody really had any idea what we were doing, what we were going to do at that time.
And as we're losing so many World War II survivors, we must be losing a whole lot of survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
When I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2016, Hiroshima lost, I think, I want to say 7,000 to 9,000, similar to Nagasaki. Yeah.
Ooh. So how do we keep all of this alive and keep a watch on those 17,000 atomic bombs when these eyewitness stories aren't with us anymore?
Well, people have recorded them. I think we need to, while we still have survivors, talk to them, listen to them, write it down. It's one of the reasons that Wesley and I went back in 2013 and recorded survivor testimony. We have 20 audiovisual tapes. We have 20 recorded so that people can use it. So that you know, we're working to make that available, to have it translated cleanly and make it available for the Truman College, to the Truman Library website, so that researchers, the media, anybody can use those stories and keep them alive. But and the survivors only ever asked me one thing. No survivor ever asked me for an apology, but several of them did say, please, just help keep telling these stories. So that's what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing who your grandfather was and how you have taken a good portion of one of the biggest things he ever did in his life and put it in a whole new direction and a healing direction, too? It's a good thing, Clifton, isn't it? It's a good thing.
It is. He actually sort of set the template for this. He didn't intend to. When he went on a state visit to Mexico in 1947, he laid a wreath at the monument to the 6 Mexican Army cadets who had fought to the death against U.S. forces in 1847. And, of course, an American journalist with the group asked him afterwards, why did you lay a wreath at a memorial, a monument, to our enemies? And my grandfather said, because they had courage. Courage doesn't belong to any one country. You honor courage wherever you find it. Likewise, suffering in war does not belong to any one country. And I think we can all have the empathy to honor it where we find it.
Mm. Thank you so much. Well, I'm going to get off the air and go to the website for the Truman Library.
Okay.
I think that would be a good thing to do.
Those videos aren't up yet. We're still working on
it.
But there's lots of other good stuff.
I bet there is. I'm going to take a look. Clifton, thank you so much. I knew you were going to. I've been wanting to interview you for a long time, and I'm glad we were finally able to make a connection. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Our guest, Clifton Truman Daniel, the grandson of President Harry Truman. who made the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima 71 years ago. That took place this coming Saturday, August 6th. On August 9th, the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. He's an interesting guy, isn't he? He's done some remarkable work, and he is also author of, I've read parts of his book, but not all of it. He's written a book about his grandfather, and he's writing a memoir now as well. Thanks so much to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thank you, Kiri Salinas, for on-air production. All Things Political, the next time we'll be with you on Monday. Our guest will be Dan DeSalvo, the senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute.